going on, everyone? Welcome to episode 32 of the Data Driven Strength Podcast. Today, myself and Zach have a few questions lined up. We'll be talking about how you should expect to feel, or potential individual differences in how you feel during a deload week. We're going to talk about overreaching for hypertrophy. We're going to talk about the concept of adaptive resistance and how that influences individualization. We'll also talk about how to tell whether a lack of progress is due to insufficient recovery or whether it's just a bad training program for that individual. So this will be kind of a divergence from the recent way we've been doing episodes. We're just going to be doing some questions today. We've had a few episodes where we mean to get to questions, but then run out of time. So we're going to kind of clear the decks here and answer some of these questions, which are all really, really good questions. Before I kick the first question over to Zach, if you want to support what we do here at Data Driven Strength, check out the description of the podcast, whether you're on YouTube or a podcast player. Check out some of the stuff we offer. And we also appreciate any ratings and reviews, whether that's on iTunes or on your podcast player of choice. So with that out of the way, Zach, our first question is from Sierra Whiskey 85. He or she says, how should you feel at the end of a deload week versus the start?
Yeah, this is a good question. I think I get this question a little over half of the clients that I have probably at some point of like, hey, it's a deload and I'm still feeling pretty beat up. What's the deal with that? And it's a common, I think, kind of observation of like the time course of how you're feeling with this kind of thing. On the front end, I think the answer to this question is definitely dependent on a few factors, though. I think it definitely depends on like the aggressiveness of training coming into a deload, the timing of said deload, and then ultimately how you are actually programming a deload. I think all of those factors are kind of important and contextual to the answer here. But in general, if I'm speaking in generalities, I would say that depending on, again, the timing of when you do things, which most people are going to deload when they kind of feel like they need one. I would say that my typical observation, at least, is that you don't really start to feel the effects of the deload until kind of the following week, as opposed to, this is session one of deload. Therefore, I start feeling fresher immediately after that first session. I don't know why that is, but that seems to be a pretty consistent observation in my experience that, for a moderate deload, pulling back on volume a little bit, maybe load and proximity to failure a bit as well, the effects are a little bit delayed. So throughout that deload week, you can somewhat expect, in my experience, to still feel a little bit fatigued, beat up potentially. And then once you get into that, the intro week or the first week of the next block, whatever style you kind of utilize, that's generally when I experience the kind of the fatigue reduction effects of that deload. But again, that's going to be dependent on how you do things. If you're considering a deload a few days off, that might change the kind of the time course of those things. But if you're kind of taking a standard approach, that is my general experience there. But Josh, I know you got some stuff on this, so I'll kick it to you.
No, I think you covered the main things I wanted to touch on. Like, I think we find ourselves reassuring lifters that, hey, it's actually the most common time to experience aches and pains are in that deload week. I think that's just due to, finishing a block in general. People are, going to push a little bit harder that last week of the block. Also, there's a bit of a psychological come down as well. You can kind of, adjust your perception of discomfort by having high arousal for those sessions at the end of a block. Okay, now we're in this deload week and we're starting to experience those aches and pains or fatigue or whatever. And some people by the end of the deload week might be feeling really, really good. Other people aren't going to feel good for 10 days from the end of the last week of the block. Obviously, like Zach said, that's going to depend on how the deload is structured. But it's like Zach said, it doesn't make any sense to expect to feel good by day one of the deload week because it's the deload week. It takes time for those feelings to dissipate. My last point here is that I think this is why psychological periodization is vital. Like, it's good to kind of have that come down in the deload week and potentially have those quote unquote negative effects, because I think we do need those exposures to those hard weeks at the end of blocks, but we also need to recover from them, right? And we can kind of manipulate our psychological approach, again, at the end of a block and in a deload week. And yeah, you might kind of experience the quote-unquote consequences of that in a deload week, but I think that's okay. And then Zach, unless you have anything to add, I think that leads us nicely into the next question.
Yeah, no, go for it.
Cool. So this question is from one of Zach's clients, actually. Is it pronounced Linus? Cool. So he asks, what are your thoughts on overreaching for hypertrophy? Is it something we should intentionally leverage?
Yeah, I mean, I think the short-term answer here is that I don't think we have sufficient evidence to like really rule on this particularly hard. I think there's only one study to my knowledge that really is going to give us a ton of insight to this question. It's a study by Bjornsson and colleagues that the few kind of nuggets of this that I think are important to keep in mind is, one, it was untrained individuals. They were doing kind of a pretty non-typical training program. So it was like two blocks of very high frequency blood flow restriction training. So they were doing like five sessions per week, if I recall correctly, five sessions in a row in these kind of two blocks of training over the span of, a couple of days. Ultimately the application of those findings, I think, is limited to what we are kind of trying to extrapolate this to. So obviously the claim there would be, at least the inferred claim, is that overreaching for hypertrophy would be superior to an approach in which we don't intentionally leverage that, which I don't think this, the evidence that we have would give us that comparison. To my knowledge, there's not an approach that tries to intentionally leverage overreaching compared to a more standard approach that just kind of uses progressive overload and potentially deloads. I think I would want to see that. And then I also want to see that in a more kind of ecologically valid training program. Again, not to say that the program utilized to investigate this isn't useful. Obviously, it's extremely useful to know that this can occur to some degree. Just to apply this into actual training, I think we're a few steps away from that. I think, it's important to keep in mind, if I recall correctly, the trends in kind of the supercompensation of hypertrophy were different on the fiber and whole muscle level. I don't know, and I don't think there's a clear answer to know which of those is more important. I think a lot of people would kind of tend to think that the biopsy answer is more, high quality and such. I don't know if that's super clear cut because of some of the logistics that go into, muscle biopsy measurements. Like, you're only getting a certain section of the quadriceps, along the length of a muscle that, is probably not the same every single time you take the measurement. Like, there's just a bunch of logistics and assumptions that kind of go into making that measurement, whereas the whole muscle, at least in theory, is kind of the more global comparison of what we actually care about to some degree, but that has limitations as well. But all of this is just to say that I think, while super interesting and something we'll definitely keep our eyes on, I don't know if I have a strong opinion from evidence. Now, talking purely anecdotally for a moment, I don't know. It's very similar to overreaching for strength for me. Like, to me, the risk reward doesn't make a ton of sense. Like, if the thing that's going to get us the best, gain over the long run, as opposed to just thinking within the context of like a mesocycle or a block, is sustained, consistent progression over time, I'm generally inclined to take less radical approaches, in which, just applying progressive overload and increasing the training dose when needed probably makes more sense to me, rather than, intentionally overreaching at semi-frequently intervals. But that's just the way that I think about it. But Josh, I don't know if you have any different thoughts.
No, I think that was spot on. I think you might do hard weeks, kind of bias hard weeks towards the end of a block, which is when you would do this kind of quote unquote overreaching strategy.
Yeah, I think hard weeks and overreaching in this context are extremely different though.
Yeah, so that's kind of what I'm getting at is, like, I'm not going to do a hard week for the purpose of overreaching, because I think it'll lead to net greater gains. Because like you said, that study you mentioned did kind of see that quote unquote like delayed hypertrophic effect. But there's no comparison, right? Like it's an interesting proof of concept, but we would need a sequence of additional studies to kind of tell us, like to kind of indicate, hey, is the risk that comes with one of these hard overreaching weeks that, yeah, is risky, like to some degree. If you're like overreaching by definition is training, applying so much training stress that your performance capabilities goes down significantly, at least by the end of the week. And I don't think the juice is worth the squeeze quite yet, or just based on kind of what we have right now because of that non-zero risk that you mentioned. But that's not to say you aren't going to push hard at the end of a week and then, you know, kind of recover and I guess adapt in the week after in the deload week, like we were just talking about in the previous question, but it's not necessarily because we think there's something special to overreaching.
Yeah, I guess I view like the hard week followed by a deload more as a strategy of fatigue management rather than like trying to leverage adaptation per se. I also like thinking about this in the concept of like different, not like non-training, like thought experiments. So like overreaching in the context of like the suntan analogy that people use a lot, like you would never go out and just like absolutely fry yourself with the expectation that's going to get you to the most golden brown in the long run. At least I don't think that makes sense at face validity. Now, is there limitations in that analogy? Of course, but I guess that's just my gut reaction is like, I'm just a little bit skeptical that's going to get us to a net greater place than a more moderate, consistent approach over time. Although it makes sense with people's impulse generally to push the intensity, push the volume, push everything to try to, you know, eke out more gains. So, I'm curious to see where this area of research goes, but I think that's pretty much all we got at the moment. So Josh, you got anything to add?
I will say there's that study from, I think it's from Scarpelli, in which they did see kind of, I guess, an inherent benefit to increasing volume above baseline from previous training, previous training volumes, which I guess some people could say that like, hey, there's going to be a benefit to really cranking it up for the short term, because this study kind of indicates that. But that study was over the course of like an entire training program. I want to say it was like a 20% increase. That's not that much, assuming
10 to 12 sets.
I think we've kind of done that one justice. It's an interesting thought. There definitely could be something there. I don't think it's a terrible idea, but there's a non-zero risk, and yeah, our personal preference isn't to do it right now. And I would say definitely for strength, I think you can run into the risk is greater, and the mechanism for benefit is also like less clear, or mechanism for potential benefit is less clear.
Yeah. I'll let you read in the next one, Josh, because you got a question on Instagram.
So you want, okay. I'll read this one into you. I guess you can start it off and then we can go from there. So I had a post recently in which I was, so exactly what it kind of says in the graphic is small methodical programming changes are the fastest way of finding what works. So I'm basically kind of making the case of, you know, not completely overhauling things and then you're kind of taking the shotgun approach and then you have no way of actually kind of telling what works. And there's a really good question in the comments from, I have no idea what this handle is. It's BEBJ with a couple of underscores. And this individual said, how does one mitigate the fact that progress derived from a particular configuration of training variables has limited validity, especially due to the diminishing returns or the slowing rate of progress seen across a training career? So I thought that was a really good question to kind of, you know, how do we hold one, how do we consider the fact that you might not see the exact same results from a training program if you kind of repeat a similar structure just with some small changes?
Go for it. Take that one.
Yeah. So I think a couple things here. The first is I think that periodization covers you to some degree. So in other words, it's not like you're taking a 4-week training block that is like extremely static in its approach and then repeating that over and over. And thus, yeah, things might get a little bit stale. But instead, if you're taking like a general periodization model in which rep range is modulated, proximity to failure is modulated, maybe even exercise selection is modulated throughout that training cycle, and you use that structure and apply it to the next one and make some changes, I think you kind of check that box of like making sure things aren't too stagnant and like just become too stale, if you will. So that's the first thing. The second thing that I would say is, even within the small methodical programming changes, yes, I use the word small, but it still needs to be a meaningful programming change, right? Going from, you know, a totally like a certain top set configuration to another, or a certain training volume to another. Yes, it needs to be small, but it also needs to be meaningful to be able to detect a difference. And that'll kind of hopefully cover you in terms of like that diminishing returns type of effect. Okay. The last thing I'd say, at least for now, and then I'll see what you think, Zach, is that it's not like you find this kind of like magic formula that works for you, and then you just follow that blindly, but instead you're kind of mixing in some systematic variation and these periodization structures, and you're being reactive as you go, but you know that in general, okay, this is a good place for this individual's training volume, for their top set configuration, for how much volume we're pushing towards specific movements versus non-specific movements. And then you kind of tweak from there in meaningful enough ways to detect whether that was a fruitful change, right? So that I'll kind of pause there and see what you have to fill in there, Zach.
Yeah, I guess I interpreted this a little bit differently than you potentially, maybe not, but I guess what I heard was this diminishing returns and kind of adaptive resistance or whatever is inhibiting our ability to individualize things over time, or like that's not allowing us to effectively make those small methodical changes with any confidence. To me, I almost in a way see the diminishing returns potentially as something that's helpful in a way, because if you are diminishing the rate of progress over time, especially after your first few years of training, which we know that many more things are on the table for whatever is going to allow you to make a meaningful rate of progress, to which individualization is a little bit less consequential. But after you get past that initial, you know, fast rate of gain, and you are dealing with these diminishing returns, I think it helps to distinguish whether you're on the right track a little bit easier in a way, because if you are making progress, you're probably on the right track, to which smaller chains to try to optimize that rate of progress are fine. But if we're not making progress at all, that's when we know we need to make those larger scale changes. I guess that's the way that I view it. Of course, you know, dealing with, you know, smaller margins of actual gain is going to, you know, make things a little bit more difficult in general. But I do think that in general, you can kind of say if you are making progress, then you're kind of on the right track. And in a way that kind of diminished rate of return can kind of help you identify that, because it's kind of either on or off. Of course, there's fluctuations within that, and we can make some smaller changes to try to optimize rate of progression. But that's kind of been a shifting perspective for me over time, is, you know, the grass really almost isn't greener if you are, in fact, making progress.
Yeah. Looking back at this question, I think I was kind of focused on the first part and you were focused on the second part. So the first part is, how does one mitigate the fact that progress derived from a particular configuration of training variables has limited validity? And validity, and I guess like the dictionary sense, is like, this is something that actually indicates what is occurring in the real world, right? So based on that part of the question, that's kind of what I was getting at in terms of like, okay, what I'm hearing from that question is, you're doing a training program, you see results or you don't, but if you were to do it again, it wouldn't really happen again. It was more so kind of a novelty thing, or repeating it again wouldn't lead to the same results because of maybe like this concept of like adaptive resistance. And we could obviously go down that rabbit hole of whether that's something actually worth worrying about. And again, that's kind of where I was coming from. And then what you're saying is that, yes, slowing rate of progress is going to occur, but that doesn't mean you can't still detect whether progress is occurring. And like you said, beyond your first couple years of training, you know, any detectable progress or convincing progress is good progress. You know what I mean? And you want to run with that. Because the alternative is to take a shotgun approach and to, you know, hope you can find a streak here or there. And then, oh, shoot, I haven't found a streak in multiple years. And now it's like, it's a net negative in the long term. Whereas if you can be methodical and still kind of apply some novelty, okay, we're changing this exercise to this, or we're taking a different approach to rep range in this slot, or we're changing your weekly setup so that we can see if we can get a little bit higher peak intensity exposure on this day, and enough to keep the athlete engaged, I think that's where you kind of fall in the middle and you're kind of in that money range.
Yep. Cool. I'll roll into the last one here. And awesome. We'll go from there. So the last question was one I got on Instagram. I think this is a very long time ago, so I apologize for that. But this one's from Taylor Johnson. And he asks, when not experiencing progress, how do you tell if it's insufficient recovery versus the stimulus is not appropriate for the trainee?
Yeah, so I think the first thing to say is you're never going to know for sure in the moment. But you can make hypotheses and then test those hypotheses and then determine whether that hypothesis was more or less likely to have been correct at the time of making that hypothesis, right? So if someone isn't experiencing progress, is it a fact that it's just too much work for the individual and they're not recovering? Or maybe it's just that the training program and the configuration isn't good. I think you can look at past training history for clues to form a hypothesis. I think asking for subjective input is probably going to be the primary one in terms of looking for clues. And then you form a hypothesis. So if they feel beat up all the time and, you know, maybe an ache or a pain that kind of seems to correlate with training stress is, you know, kind of nagging or whatever. Okay, maybe it is kind of this insufficient recovery issue. And it's not that the kind of configuration of the stimulus is incorrect. It's rather just a dosage problem. Okay, that's our hypothesis. We do the best we can. We test that hypothesis. We see what happens. And then, hey, maybe we were wrong, right? I think, again, kind of going back to that last question, is that's the only thing you can do in practice, because you don't have the athlete in front of you in two parallel universe and, you know, have one of them do a certain potential solution and another do another potential solution. So yeah, that's where my head goes. You can't know for sure. Form hypotheses, test that hypothesis, and then see if you were right or wrong. And hopefully you get better at forming those hypotheses over time.
Yeah, I really don't have much to add. Kind of the flow chart in my mind is to, if you're not making progression, the first thing is to check the quality of your current training. Are you appropriately taking your sets to adequate proximity to failure? Are we addressing, you know, if you're training for strength, the actual limiter that we perceive to be the problem, and how are you actually executing the exercises that are designed to attack a certain area? That's the first thing I definitely would check. The second thing is, what do we expect your life context to be appropriate for you to see a fast rate of progression? If yes, then we can kind of move to the next rung of the ladder. If no, then probably a little bit more likely to either keep the dosage the same or decrease the dosage. But if your life context is appropriate to potentially see progression, then we would just make sure that, you know, the logistics in your recovery would suggest that that's actually something that's going to be worthwhile and worth doing. If you're subjectively already beat up and super sore all the time, probably not the first area we want to go. But if you're feeling okay, recovered, and logistically you think adding an additional volume and additional training time isn't going to be a huge problem and inevitably not be sustainable, then we can give it a shot. And so that's pretty much the exact same thing you said.
Yeah. And I would not skip over that point you were saying about, like, are you in a life context that, you know, would allow you to see a meaningful rate of progression or a fast rate of progression, right? So in other words, making sure life context, training age, like everything is set up so that your expectations are realistic. Because I think a lot of people get stuck right there and their expectations are either unrealistic and or their ability for assessing progress is poor. And I think that leads a lot of people to assume that 3 weeks into this program, it's not working. And then you kind of go back to that shotgun approach, like we were just talking about. So being able to detect whether things are moving in the right direction at a rate that is satisfactory based on your training age and your life context, that is absolutely massive. Because if you don't have those detection methods, then you're just kind of using your intuition, and oftentimes your intuition is not going to be very good. So that's why I think having like an objective outsider can be really, really helpful. I feel like that's my job half the time, is like, okay, looking at week 9 from cycle A compared to week 9 in cycle C. Okay, you know, so a few months later, let's see kind of where we're at in a similar context in terms of fatigue and your performance here. Maybe look at barbell velocity. Are we seeing detectable improvements? Even if the athlete doesn't feel like, oh my gosh, we're putting 50 kilos on my total every cycle. Having that objective source, I think, is just massive. Because, you know, when you take a step back and you think of what over the course of 5 years would be like satisfactory progress. Okay, let's break that down into 1 year. Now let's break that down into one training cycle, let alone one training block. It's like, it gets pretty hard to detect, right? So having realistic expectations and a good way to detect that progress, I think, is key. And then, okay, based on Taylor's question, if you're truly not experiencing progress after that, then we start to get into the troubleshooting. But I think it is important to emphasize that process of actually determining whether satisfactory progress is occurring or not. Cool. Go ahead and wrap it up there. Thank you guys for tuning in. We appreciate it. And again, leave us a rating or review if you found this stuff valuable. And we'll see you next time.